This next book project that I'm working on has is deeply related to this question of beauty and how and you may be familiar, there are a number of people that are writing about this, and a couple of authors have two separate books that have the same title, Beauty Will Save the World. And I just want to say, after sitting back there and in 15 minutes feeling like I have just gotten a master's degree in fine arts of glitter, the level of nuance and the level of detail and like that one would be so curious about so many different layers of experience. It's a really, really lovely thing, and so we serve a God who is that interested in every detail of who we are, and which is relevant to why I'm here. I noticed there's some who have children here. Is that right? I mean, your children are actually here, right? And are any of those children males? Any of them? Thanks be to God. Because, right, you can, like, being the only guy here, it's good to know that even if they're very, very small, that I have other, like, men in the room. So, the title of our talk, I don't know if they published this or did they send it to you or something. I think it's something to the effect of, what is it? What's the title?
Parenting with Your Brain in Mind.
Right, but there's something else, right?
In what story are you living?
Yeah, in what story are you living, right? In what story do you believe you're living, right? And so I want to do two things today. I want to talk about that question, in what story do you believe you're living? And talk about how that question is significantly impacting the other question, which is what it means for us to parent our children with our brain in mind. Not parenting our children with their brain in mind. I mean, that's important. But parenting our children with our brain in mind. So I'll start with this. One of the things that we say about human beings is that, you know, if you compare us to all the other animals in the world, as far as we know, we are the only animals that tell stories, as far as we know, right? Other animals may be telling stories, but they're not telling us the stories that they're telling, right? Dogs may be telling stories, but they're not telling us, as far as, unless, like, you're in a C.S. Lewis novel, right? Other than that, other animals don't do this. We tell stories about absolutely everything. And in fact, we can't not tell stories. And there's an interesting way in which we eventually get to this point of storytelling, because we don't just, like, come out of the uterus telling stories, because as far as we know, newborns don't have language, at least as far as we know, other than just screaming, right? That's about as sophisticated as it gets, right? But there are some things about the storytelling process that are important for us to know. And there are four or five things that are helpful for us to know about how stories actually develop and emerge over the course of our time as human beings. The first thing to know is that your story was being told about you long before you ever arrived, right? That's the first thing to know about storytelling, that your story begins with somebody else telling it, right? So, you know, at some point you were conceived, and when you were, somebody decided certain things about that fact, and they started telling things about you. So I was born in 1962 to parents who were 45. Now, if you're 45 in 1962 and you're pregnant, people are worried. There were, like, my father and mother, Lewis and Betty Thompson, right? People were like, because I had three older brothers when I was born. They were 18, 16, and 11. And then I came along, and people were like, well, Lewis, but, like, what were you doing? Like, well, we know what you were doing. But I mean, why are you, because in 1962, if you're pregnant at age 44, you're worried. Because, I mean, now it's much more common for a person to be pregnant in her 40s. Common. But when you're there, like, you're worried medically. You're worried for a lot of different reasons, like, and so the thing is that my story began in, like I'm an anxiety-provoking thing. That's exactly what I am, right? They were all like, oh my gosh, a fourth is on the way. No, that's not what they were thinking. And so that's something to consider, that like you became a story in your parents' mind in some way, shape, or form long before you're ever like even close to being like noticeable in your mother's uterus. So that's one thing, that your story was told by someone else long before you ever arrived. And it was told in a certain way. Does that make sense? Now here's the other thing. Even after you arrive, bless you, even after you arrive, your story is told by somebody else, right? Because that you have babies here and you put them in clothing. Clothing that like 20 years from now they wouldn't be caught dead in. Right? Who as an adult wears a onesie? Right? You wouldn't do this, right? Like then there's all kinds of things that we do to our children, right? We tell their story, like what they wear, what they're like. We give them play dates with people that they don't want to be in the room with. Right? We know this. Oh, you guys are going to be such good friends. I hate her. So the first thing we know is like our stories are being told by somebody else long before they're told by us. And that then leads to the second thing, which is that, you know, children eventually get to a point where they have more and more independence in terms of the story about themselves that they want to tell, right? So they decide that they want to go this way when you want them to go that way. Now, they might not be using words, but they're like telling their story non-verbally. They're saying, I want to go this direction. You want them to go that direction. And in this way, they are starting to tell more and more and more of their story. Before long, they're going to like decide that they want to go off and have a date with this girl, and you don't want them to have a date with that girl. You want them to have a date with this other girl, right? All these kinds of things in which the second thing becomes true about stories. Stories are always eventually told collaboratively. In the end, you don't ever tell your story by yourself. Here's an example. It's already happened here this morning. You've just been exposed to some really, really beautiful stuff up here about fashion. Would that be fair to say? And some of you are going to go home and you're going to take what you've learned and you're going to apply this. And when you do, you're telling a story about yourself. But you don't do it without your words. Like, we're doing this together. And we don't ever not do this. One of the questions that we often have to ask folks is, especially when they come to see us in the clinic, we ask, like, well, who are the people who are in your life who are helping you tell your story? It's not a matter of, like are there people? There are always other people who are collaboratively helping you tell your story. Now, you're the voice of your story, right? You're the author of your story, but you always have other people who are collaboratively telling your story with you. Now, this leads to another piece of this, which is that most stories, you can give us information about clothing, but really, the information itself is not what's more important. What's important is like what I'm actually seeing, what I'm feeling, sensing, right? All the clothing is it, right? You can give me language, but you're giving me language that is really helping me like live into the thing that I want to put on, right? The language in and of itself is important, but it's not most important. We tell folks, look, we remember the things that we sense and that we image and that we feel far more than the language that we hear, right? So one of the questions that we then ask is, what are the other things that you're sensing, imaging, and feeling about your stories? Not just your words, right? Because so much of how our stories are told involves other kinds of experiences that don't have anything to do with language, right? Why we would say that, 70 to 90% of all human communication is nonverbal in nature. It's got nothing to do with the words that I speak, but it has to do with those seven different things that we communicate with Non-verbally. There's another piece about storytelling that's important, and that is that stories are also told effectively by the people who listen to them. Stories are told effectively by the people who listen to them. If you're telling your story to anybody here you're at a party and you're in the middle of a conversation with two or three other people. I understand there's some folks here from Rivendell, is that true? Anybody here like admit that you won't get your kids go to Rivendell? Yeah, well, our kids went to Rivendell, right? Our kids a long time ago. Our kids are 28 and 25 now. And, if you go to gatherings of all kinds, right? Rivendell gatherings or other gatherings, and you're there, anybody ever been in a conversation in which, you're there with two or three people and you say something and you offer something, and the conversation just keeps going without your words being acknowledged. Does that ever happen? No, well, probably not. You're all really important people here. All of your words are held to be in deep esteem, and so like everybody's always like hanging on every word, right? Does that ever happen? Like where you tell, and then nobody. It appears that your words have been ignored. I hate that. Right? I mean, we don't like when our words, because our stories are told in order to be heard. Like, our stories aren't just these things that happen to exist out there in the universe. They are told, we tell them because we long, more than anything else, we long to be seen, to be felt, to be heard, to be held, to be contained. We want to be wanted. And we want to be wanted in ways in which we're not going to be exploited or used. And so if I'm the listener, it's important to know that, like, I'm receiving somebody's story, and in so doing, I am as important a part of that storytelling venture as they are. Now, this is, so this notion that your story began long before you ever existed, that your story is always told collaboratively, that your story is mostly told not with words, but with nonverbal cues, that your story is as important because it's important because it really wants to be heard, like you want to be heard. You don't just want to tell it for the sake of telling it. And the notion that you as a listener are as important a part of someone else's telling their story as they are as they tell it. So we've got all this storytelling thing going on. And like, what's that got to do with the development of your children's brain? What's that got to do with any or all of that? My wife, Phyllis, I tell folks, look, if it weren't for her, my kids would either be dead or in jail. if it were just up to me, right? And, she's a licensed clinical social worker, and she's had plenty of practice because she lives with me, just living in the house. And, one of the things that she has said over and over, she said, our job as parents is to interpret the world for our children. That's what we do. We're interpreters of the world. But it's important to know that in order for me to interpret the world for my children, I have to be deeply aware of my interpretive mechanism. And my interpretive mechanism for my children is not just my awareness of some abstract set of facts about the world. The most powerful interpretive mechanism I have for my children is my own story. You see, when we ask the question, how are we parenting our children with our brain in mind, it's really crucially important. Certainly we're thinking about our kids' brains, but it's important to know that the impact that I have on my child's brain is influenced by nothing, any more importantly than whether or not I've made sense of my own story. Many of us here in the room might be familiar with attachment research on this notion that, like, as human beings, we were made in such a way that it's not good for us to be alone. And our brain evidence, the research on relationships and attachment and the development of the middle prefrontal cortex is now just replete with all kinds of evidence that indicates that to the degree that we have healthy, secure attachments, we not only develop the middle prefrontal cortex very, very well, but we also go into adulthood to develop strong, healthy relationships, and it also translates into how we then operate in all kinds of vocational domains, not just relationships, what we do at work, what we do with our play, what we do with a whole range of other things, not least of which being how we actually make ourselves available for our spiritual formation. Because, we love to, like delude ourselves into thinking that, like, I can have this relationship with God in which I trust God, and God and I, we're cool, but, like, it's people that I can't stand, right? Like, the world would be fine if it weren't for humans, right? Like, that's just an illusion. Like, what I do with God, I'm doing with people. What I'm doing with people, I'm doing with God. There are parts about my life in my relationship with God that are going to be deeply reflected in my relationship with people, and especially those parts of me that I hate the most that are yet to be exposed to other people. The degree to which my relationship with God is reflected in a robust space of formation is a direct reflection of the degree to which the deepest parts of my story that are most broken and are most shameful have been exposed to those that I trust in order for that space in between us to be used by the Holy Spirit to transform who I am. This is how Jesus does his work. And they will know that you are my disciples by the way you do what? Love one another. You know, he doesn't say, they'll know that you are my disciples because of your philosophy. They'll know you're my disciples because of your theology. No, they'll know that you're my disciples because of the way you love one another. So, I'm the youngest of four sons, right? And that's one way for me to tell my story. But a couple of years ago, a very close friend of mine, one Christmas, he pointed out to me, he said, well, you know, that's the way, every time we talk about our lives and together, he said, that's how you introduce yourself. You're the youngest of four sons, which is a fact, right? It's true. My oldest brother was born, and 1 week later, went out to college, and 1 week later, I was born, right? So he and I, like, he's old enough to be my dad, and he and I, right, but he and I, really, like, we've had very, like, no relationship, because he goes off to college. Like, it's not his fault. I mean, like, it's not his fault that my parents waited to then to have that sexual moment, when then there comes Kurt, right? Yeah. But my friend said a couple years, and he said, but you know, there's another way for you to tell your story, which is equally true. He said, you could also say that you're the firstborn of a second family, which is also true, right? Because by the time I was five, all my brothers were out of the house. And I spent most of my growing up years as an only kid. And you know, if you're the, anybody here a firstborn? Oh, yeah. Okay. So, and like, stereotypically, not always, but stereotypically, like, firstborns, we like to toe the line. We like to know the thing. We like to know where the lines are. We like to know what the rules are. And we like to control everybody who's coming behind us. Right? Because we want to make sure that if we're going to, like, paint inside the lines, that everybody else is doing the same thing. Right? We like to do that. And has anybody here are anybody here the youngest? Ooh, yes. Right? Anybody here? And what do youngest get to do? That's right, get to do, right? Whatever they want, right? Okay, again, not in all cases, but whatever we want to do. And so there were things that I actually got to do because my parents raised sons, check it out, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, right? That's like, some of you don't even know that there was a 1940, right? I mean, that's a big difference in terms of, like, how parents understand their story such that story gets then translated into the lives of the sons that they're raising. Does that make sense? Right. So, as it turns out, at the same time that there were things that I got to do because I was the youngest and came along later, much later, it's also true that because I grew up as kind of a firstborn of a second family, I was also temperamentally one of those guys who, like, I'm just going to do the right thing. Like, oh, we're going to make sure that everybody's doing the right thing, right? And so, unbeknownst to me, though, something else that happened in my family. I grew up in this house where I have two parents who love God and who love each other, but, you know, but they're not perfect. And one of the ways that they were imperfect was that my dad, though a lovely, lovely person, you know, he didn't really take any crap from anybody, right? He wanted things done his way, and if they didn't get done his way, like, you could feel, like, his kind of irritation and kind of anger come to the surface pretty quickly. And so one of the things that I ended up doing, kind of unbeknownst to me, is that I ended up being a person who, because I'm that, like, firstborn of a second family, like, I'm working really hard to make sure that I don't piss him off. Does that make sense? But you don't really know that. You don't really know that as a 3-year-old or as a 10-year-old. That's not what you're aware that you're doing. And my mom, again, a woman of great faith, but also of great anxiety. And so I spent some of my time in my growing up years, like, working really hard to make sure that I didn't make her anxious. And so, but I don't know this. Working really hard to make sure that I don't piss people off and I don't make them anxious. Now, here's another part of my story. 14 years ago, I lost one of my brothers to pancreatic cancer. 4 years ago, I lost a second brother to prostate cancer, and in June, I lost my third and oldest brother to prostate cancer. So it, like, oddly enough, left me as the only remaining member of my family of origin, which is kind of weird. It's just like, you don't, like, wake up and wonder, well, I wonder if I will ever be the last remaining person in my family. You're not thinking these questions, and then there you are. And suddenly, there was nobody left for me to have to worry about being angry about or being anxious around. Does that make sense? And suddenly, I discover in the wake of my third brother's death, for a whole range of reasons, like, I'm just furious. And I'm like a gathering, this happened in June, and I'm like a gathering storm. And I suddenly realized, oh my goodness. So much of my story has included working really, really hard to contain this much anger and this much anxiety. Now, I'll tell you, like, if you're doing what I'm doing from the time I was little, it's good training to become a shrink, right? Because you're working really hard to pay attention to what else is going on in the room so that you can know this, right? So that you can write prescriptions, right? This is what this is all about. But you don't recognize that in the process of doing that, you're working really hard to not let yourself tell the truth about what you are sensing, imaging, feeling, thinking, and so forth. No, does that make sense?
Yes.
And invariably, it affects how you raise your kids. Because it means that when your kids are doing things that are like might be making other people in the room anxious, like you move to control them because like you're not just trying to like turn them into good citizens, you're trying to like regulate your own story that you don't even know you're trying to regulate. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so I've spent the last 3 months, right? So recognizing this thing, like, oh my gosh, like there are these people, this work that I do to not let myself be angry or anxious because like who knows what might happen in the room. No more so have I done that than in my marriage, right? So I'm working really hard to make sure that I don't make my wife anxious or make my wife angry. I can guarantee you I'm not alone as a husband in this regard. But here's the thing. In so doing, there are things that are taking place within me that I feel and that I sense and I image that are having an impact on how I am with my children. And I'm not really aware that what I'm ending up doing is shaping their brain based on the way I'm actually taking care of my story in ways in which like I've got unfinished business. Does that make sense? So my invitation for us, so there's been all this work that I've had to do in the last like 3 months, and you're thinking like, gosh, why? Like, I'm 56 years old. Why is it? Like, why did it take until now? Like, why couldn't I have discovered this when I was like 16 or 26, right? Why is it that I'm having it like, and you think, if only I had done this or this or this or this, like when I was younger. And so I'm actually, not only do I discover that there are things that I didn't know, and I'm having to work out all this unfinished business, I'm also really kind of mad about it. Right? Mad because I have concerns about how this has affected my kids, how this has affected my marriage, all these kinds of things. And here's one thing I want to invite us just to consider. Jesus isn't worried about this. We work with adolescents in our practice, and parents come in, and you know, one of the things, and they're worried. And I get it. For a whole range of reasons. And I get that. And one of the things that we try to faithfully tell parents is that, look, Jesus is not worried about your kid. He's not worried about your kid. You're like, well, he should be. And I've got some things to say to him if he's not worried. You're like, look what's happening. And you say, no, Jesus isn't worried because he's too busy working. He's too busy doing everything he possibly can on your child's behalf. And the thing is, he is here asking you, not just what are you going to do about your kid, what are you going to do about your own story? That's what he's asking you. What is about your own story that has you in a position where you're worrying about your child instead of trusting me with it? This is what Jesus is asking. How is it that it's so hard for you to trust? And the thing is it like, oh, as it turns out, like it's hard for me to trust because I'm sure in the course, the minute that I do, I'm going to do something wrong and it's going to piss you off and then there will be hell to pay. One of the things that we're finding is we're doing a lot of, this has been in the last year or more, but especially within the last year, 15 months, we've been doing a lot more group work in our practice. And what we're finding when we bring men and women together in these small groups, in which things become pretty quickly pretty intimate, right? And by intimate, I mean like we're talking about things that we feel at levels of depth that you just don't have measurement for. And people find, they find themselves being seen and heard by people even of the opposite gender. Of course, this can make people nervous because it means that like my story is actually being heard sometimes by somebody in the group. and it feels like I'm like he or she is hearing things more effectively than my own spouse does. Right? Right? And it's like, oh, shoot, that's not, like, that's bad karma. Right? No, what it is, I want to assure you, it's the work of the Holy Spirit accessing parts of our story that we don't know about. Parts of our story where places are broken, wounded, and are waiting for God to do the work of healing in order for, as you take care of your own story, you're actually more... Wow, I didn't see that coming. You're actually more able, to sense and hear and feel and image your own child's story that much more effectively because yours is not getting in the way. And so, with that in mind, we do have to ask the questions back again. If we're going to really tell our stories well in order to help our children and help them interpret the world for them, what's the nature of your story before you were born? What do you know about that? Who are the people who are helping you tell your story effectively? That's the second thing we want to know. What's the way in which you tell your story? You think you're telling your story. I have a person who came to see me, and we were talking about just various things about their life, and they said, standard kind of question that we ask in a psychiatric evaluation, well, can you tell me about what it was like growing up in your home? And they said, well, I grew up in a really loving Christian home, which for many people is code for it really sucked, but they can't really say that. And so I said, the next, of course, obvious question that follows is, well, who was in charge of discipline in your house? It's a common question that gets asked at many cocktail parties. Who's in charge of discipline in your house? Right? And of course, this person goes on to say, well, I guess as it turns out, it was my mom, because if my dad ever got involved, brutal things started to happen in the house. My dad, who was a deacon in the church. Right, and so how is it that I think I tell a story, that my story is that I grew up in a house of two loving Christian parents, and as it turns out, it's an abject lie. Not because I'm trying to tell because I'm trying to not tell the truth, but because this is what I had to tell in order for me to survive living in my house. And so who are the people who are helping me tell my story truly? And are they helping me tell it to the depths of what it is? Are they giving the opportunity for me to be listened to in ways that bring forth that story? And how and who and in whose lives am I also doing the same thing? Such that this space of new life and new creation, the kingdom of God that we are so longing for, can be ushered in. I'm going to stop with that. Thank you very much. I think you have questions that you've given to folks, right? Is that right? Okay. So anyway, thanks.